Okay. We should be live. Let's just make sure things filter through. And once we're good to go and we know some folks are watching, we'll get into it. I know
We gotta
Mr.
get some
Justin's
Xander
in the.
Jones music to play here.
Well, speak of the devil, Mr. Justin just sent me an intro song, but I'm seeing it too late. So for the next live stream, we will have an intro song. Now, if we're live, guys, and good to go, can you please just let us know in the comments if sound's working for everybody, if video's working, if the stream's all right, just let us know, please.
Shout out Mr. Justin, man. It's
Sweet.
great getting to
Mr.
be in my
Justin's.
contact.
Yeah. The best way to let us know that we're live, guys, is to like, comment, and subscribe.
Kerm, do you see the flux liner over my left shoulder? Mr. Justin made me that. It's over my left shoulder. You might not be able to
Yes.
see it right now, but the top of the desk, that was a Mr. Justin special. So
Nice.
he came over, he watched the White House UFC card with me, and he brought me some gifts. Mr. Justin's the man.
Nice. Yeah, no,
Nice.
I can see it up there. That's pretty sweet. What a
Okay,
great card.
gentlemen. Oh, okay. Mr. Justin's in there. Okay. So now that we're starting and people are rolling in, everybody knows at this point who you gentlemen are. But guys, also, thank you very much. We are heckin' live. If you guys would just take 30 seconds, 60 seconds to introduce yourselves, let the folks in the chat know who you are if they don't already, and then we'll get started.
My name is Kermit. I've been friends with Gerb and Rob here for a couple of years, been covering this UFO thing kind of in the back channels, if you will. I'm more kind of on the financial side of this subject and conversation. That's what I like to talk about. So fun working with Gerb and Rob covering these events, live streams, the hearings. Been to a lot of the stuff. So it's always a time with these gents. So excited to get into today's discussion.
Yeah, and for those that don't know, my name is Rob Jones. I'm a research producer for Reality Check with Ross Coulthart. I am Ross Coulthart's man on the ground here in the United States, based at the DC Bureau office of News Nation. I've been friends with Gerb for several years now. We made friends early on when I was not employed within this sector. I worked in a very, very different field. And, through our friendship and the research that we've done together and the learning that we've all sort of taken part in over the course of the past several years led me to this career, and here we are, and now we're all kind of doing it. So.
Okay, so before I set the groundwork, let me say thank you to Thomas Sturtevant as well. Sir, are you related to Mary Sturtevant, the Lockheed Martin Vice President of Government Affairs from 2006 to 2021? If so, please let me know.
Not a
So to
common
st
last name.
No, it's not. And to set the stage for today, over this last weekend, Rob, of course, lives in DC as the research producer for Ross Coulthart, is doing incredible work out there. Nine times out of 10 now, Kerm accompanies the gang. We all meet up for events, whether it be hearings, Soul Conference, Contact in the Desert. And quite, he wasn't able to make this instance. So it was just Rob and I on the ground. One of the big things we'll talk about is the UAPDF event on the 25th. Both of us were there in person. And the day before, the 24th, I had the good fortune of sitting down with Mr. Ross Coulthart for about 2 hours. We recorded a very, very extensive Reality Check episode. And then, of course, today there's some breaking news on the ATIP front. So we'll talk about that as well. And one more thing I'd love to touch on too. This hasn't been uploaded yet, but on the 25th, after the UAPDF event, I went to Burleson's office because I was supposed to record a Fresh Freedom episode with Burleson. That's his podcast. I was on it before. Himself and his wonderful staffers, who you guys have met as staffers, they're great people. They sat down and said, "Hey, Gerb, can you push back your interview a little bit? Hal Putoff and Avi Loeb are coming in." And I said, "Sure, whatever. Can I sit in and watch? I'd be really intrigued." They said, "Of course." So I arrived a little early to watch them. Who else but Hal Putoff arrived first? And first of all, just Hal Putoff as a person was really easy to interact with. Himself and his wife were lovely people. His wife especially was incredibly kind. We were talking right away. We got into OSAP, ATIP debacle, some interesting revelations from a character who hasn't really commented on that too much publicly. And right away, Burleson said, "I want you on this panel with us." So we'll tuck into this as well. But I did a five-person podcast with Nate, one of Burleson's staffers, Burleson,
Great
Avi
guy.
Loeb, and Hal Putoff. And some interesting things were certainly discussed there. Guys, the most interesting thing to me is I'm sure if you've watched any of my videos, you know that I have alleged that the Kona Blue materials transfer in 2011, you know, where Lockheed Martin Space Systems Company Vice President Jim Ryder said, you know what, we'll give bits and pieces of hull or craft to the OSAP, specifically Bigelow Aerospace. I've kind of put forward some rumors that I've heard that I've been quite confident in, that these materials, at least bulkhead or bits and pieces of craft, were from the 1953 Kingman, Arizona crash retrieval. And leaving backstage discussions with Putoff, I am quite confident now that that is the case as well. He gave some very interesting answers when I pressed on that. Last thing we'll talk about as well, I did ask Lou Elizondo to his face if he was part of the Legacy program in a one-on-one interaction in which I was pretty nervous. So we'll tuck into that. Before we get into anything, Rob, so Ross Goldhart, your boss, comes in. What was it like your first time meeting Ross in person?
Oh, it was awful, man. He's terrible to work for. I never want to talk to the guy again. No, dude, of course not. Meeting Ross in person was fantastic. He's everything that you would expect of him. He's a consummate gentleman, and yet is also a scoundrel at the same time. He's a very Han Solo type character, I would say. He's very, very well traveled and is just extremely personable, not just to people that he works with or people that he wants to get access to, but everyone that he interacts with. He is very, very kind with every single person that, you know, stops him on the street or wherever have you. Him and I were going to go to lunch. It was the first time that we had ever met in person. We'd been together for less than 30 minutes of sitting together next to each other at the office. And he says, well, you know, let's go around the corner to get lunch. And as it turns out, it was two blocks for us to go to the place we were going to eat. And he was stopped six times between the way there and the way back. And it was nothing but people saying, you know, hey, you know, we love your work, so on and so forth. And every time, even though this guy is jet lagged and tired and just wants to get food, he stopped and took time for everybody, which I really respect. So,
yeah, so I rolled into the News Nation studio. First of all, it's awesome. You guys have a really cool studio. And before me, Mike Gold actually sat down with Ross, who, you know, he presented at the 2024 hearings. I sat right by him at that time. He was eating hard candy that whole hearings. But, you know, he's interesting to hear from as well. So I got to say as well, it was my first time meeting Ross, of course. Kerm, I know you've communicated with Ross via email.
Way back in the day.
He was super pleasant to interact with. One of the things that surprised me so much is he's very funny. Because, of course, after we recorded, we all went out to dinner. And Ross is hilarious. He's a great guy to talk to. We got to talk to him about some of his other cases that he's covered in the past, completely outside of UFOs. But you know, I won't soon forget that. That was awesome interacting with Ross. So without giving away too much of the sauce, Rob, you sat in for the interview. Is it going to be interesting? I just want to get an outside perspective there.
Sheesh. Yeah, I love it. I think it's going to be a great interview. There's a lot of legitimate back and forth between you and Ross that I think the audience is going to find engaging. And without saying too much, I think it's going to be a banger, man. It's a long form interview. It's one of the longer reality check episodes that we've ever done. And we had the pleasure of filming it in person, which, you know, you don't really get to do often. So I have high hopes for that one.
So I'm going to put you two on the spot here. I want to hear what you guys have to say about this, because I have a very, very extended discussion about this. Pretty recently, Ross discussed rumors of an individual being hired for a very high-level White House position to kind of spearhead the disclosure initiative. It's kind of come out since then. It you know, people talked about this on Twitter with rumors, and it was kind of confirmed through Ross. And I can confirm this as well, that that individual is Lou Elizondo, essentially the UAP czar role that he has sought for years at this point. I certainly share many concerns with that. And one of the biggest talking points Ross and I tucked into was talking about the implications of that, the possible baggage. Of course, Ross came out with some dynamite today, but let me get your guys' take before we go any further. What do you guys think of this new position with Lou?
Well, here's what I'll say, and I've spent a considerable amount of time battling on Twitter today about this. So what I would say is that, and I said this earlier, is that a disclosure effort is only as credible as the honesty of the people running it, okay? Lou has been open about the Legacy program and open about talking about the Legacy program in sworn testimony to Congress, and yet has not been open by his I'm sorry, but by his own admission, has not been open or willing to discuss his role within it. He has always deflected those questions. He does not answer those questions directly when they are posed to him. For example, his only response on Twitter today was to quote tweet someone who essentially came to his defense, but it was a non sequitur straw man defense because it wasn't attacking the actual allegation or addressing the allegation of him being a former member or current member of the legacy program in any respect. So that's what I'll say on that front, that it's very important for that position to be occupied by someone who has a devotion to the truth and a devotion to transparency and someone that the public is willing to trust in that role. Lou does have, and I think there's a, like Ross said, there's a small window here still where Lou does have the opportunity to potentially come forward and talk to the public openly about these things. Now, I don't know if he has the authorization to do that or lacks that authorization, but you know, if you're going to be given this position, the moment that you have that authorization, you need to tell all. And that's the only way that this could go well, in my opinion. I personally have doubts as to whether or not that'll take place. But those are my personal doubts. So,
yeah, and I kind of agree. And I will say, like, if you think about disclosure or the investigation of the claims thereof as kind of like an audit, having someone that may or may not be involved with those activities, that would create what are called independence concerns, because that is someone that is affiliated with the organization that is also in an oversight or kind of like an assurance role on top of it. So, I understand it's a very complicated subject, but as someone in a position of power to like enforce or advocate for disclosure, and then also there's like an allegation on the table that maybe there's like a kind of a controlled path or a controlled kind of group for that. Yeah, I would be concerned with that. So I'm a bit concerned with that.
Yeah, I'll keep some of my strong opinions for the reality check episode, because I think I kind of said it best there, especially with Ross. I'm super concerned about this. One, because there's only one right man for this job, and that's David Grush. There's only one man with the knowledge, the contacts, the ability to lead, who could fulfill a UAPZR position to help facilitate a disclosure initiative. And to help kind of reorganize the legacy program structure back onto traditional oversight. Part of the concerns with Lou that Ross touched on today is Ross basically said, Lou, I know several individuals that know you quite well. The word on the street is that you, Lou Elizondo, have participated in the legacy programs prior. And these are statements that I've come across as well that I do think are very much true. And not only that, but I'll go a bit further. I think Lou has operated at the behest of the legacy program in two different capacities. One is being the front man, like Ross talked about, for the ATIP initiative. We hear all the time about ATIP versus OSAP. I'm so glad Hal Putoff is going to open up about this a little bit, because I asked him about it in that podcast. OSAP was a real special access program. It was real. It was funded. It had an objective. One of the later objectives of the OSAP was to facilitate an intake for a craft from Lockheed Martin. That was one of the expressed objectives. Do you have something to say, Rob?
I have something to say, and I specifically want to call out this commenter in the chat, Bavid610. So the PTSD issue isn't an issue. PTSD is an issue for all combat veterans, and David Grush has a documented history of being treated for that and has gotten past that. He's talked about it multiple times, and that should not be brought up as an obstruction to someone's ability to fulfill their duty in the future after they've dealt with the issue.
I agree. Yeah, that's well said, Rob. And I think David Grush has clearly demonstrated himself to be in a capable position of both leadership and to spearhead a charge on such a complicated issue. But back to the OSAP versus ATIP. OSAP was a very real program. ATIP was not. This is kind of well known by now, but ATIP was an informal working group that was unfunded. And furthermore, the expressed purposes of ATIP was to operate as a partial disclosure initiative at the behest of Lieutenant General, then DNI James Clapper, for a cover for several National Security Council activities. The exact reason for this, I believe, is unknown. At least I'm not aware. But The culmination of the ATIP partial disclosure narrative resulted in trying to establish Hillary Clinton as president to be the disclosure president. Now, part of the reason this is a narrative control campaign or partial disclosure is there was a huge need for equity protection here. James Clapper was sort of the patchwork replacement for Dick Cheney when Dick Cheney left office as VP in 2009. From about the time 2010 to 2017, Clapper was the central figurehead for the National Council Security Council crash retrieval portfolio. And for that disclosure initiative, why he wanted to let the lid off a little bit is unclear, but clearly there was a very, very, very strong indicator that there was extensive protection to not reveal the topic of crash retrievals, not reveal the topic of technology or airframe exploitation and derivation, and that's sort of the ATIP debacle. Furthermore, the second capacity in which there are allegations of Lou Elizondo being in legacy are a very rich history of specifically program protection for National Security Council legacy program elements. And so those are the two separate things we're working with on the table right now, both of which I believe are very true.
Well, I mean, you can even point back, and credit to Red Panda Koala for pointing this out to me at one point earlier today. There was an episode of Calling All Humans, episode 33 from 2023, where Lou Elizondo specifically said in his own words, and I quote, "I left the Department of Defense to finish the very mission they gave me in the first place. I didn't ask for it. I am not a UFO guy. I'm not a ufologist. Never have been. Never will be. I'm a counterterrorism, counterespionage guy, counterintelligence, counterinsurgency. That's what I do. And it just so happens that in 2008, I was asked to apply those same skill sets into the UFO community." That's a direct quote.
There's a lot of discussion talking about Lou as a counterintelligence officer agent. I want to be a little bit more direct. I think if you're trying to question the role in which Lou directly facilitated some legacy program elements, you need to look to his position from 2013 to 2017, in which he was the director of the National Program Special Management Staff. I've been talking about this a ton in my videos lately, but the director of the NPMS is basically the second most cleared person in the entire DOD. Even more so than the director of the DOD SAPCO or the SAP Central Office, and basically less clear than the Secretary of Defense. What the director of NPMS does is coordinates special access programs between the National Security Council and DOD/IC. So when I have brought forth allegations that Lou Elizondo has been formally read into activities like Immaculate Constellation out of the National Security Council and so forth, and TTSA being sort of an operation which Lou may have sort of staged his retirement, I would highly recommend individuals look into his director of the NPMS role. What are your thoughts, Kerm?
Yeah, I think I do remember reading that part in Lou's book. I remember reading Imminent, and looking back on it, there were some things that he said in it where he basically inferred as much. So yeah, I think it goes back to, gosh, I mean, what really was his level of responsibility? I mean, we understand it was program protection and kind of that side of the house, but the level and the power structure, I think that's especially because of his role within the NPMS as well. Like, I think it does raise some red flags because it's outside of DOD. Like, he might be presumably getting orders from something higher than that as well, but I don't know.
So we've seen this before.
It's funny because that was actually specifically one of our user questions in Discord for this evening was about that NPMS role. Mm-hmm. And the short answer, I guess, to that user who asked Stoned Academia, we don't really know.
We've seen this before, right? The Yellow Fruit Unacknowledged Special Access Program, which was kind of busted open and broken in 1983 through a series of normal audits. What Yellow Fruit showed was that in the Army Special Operations Division, Army SOD, there was an unacknowledged special access program that facilitated support of the Nicaraguan cartels in South America, as well as other classified Army operations. Now, what's interesting about this is a senior staff member for the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence in the Army, Lieutenant Colonel Duncan, for the Yellow Fruit USAP, he was ordered to unofficially retire from the Army. So he quote-unquote retired from the Army, formed a company called BSI, and then continued to facilitate funds for the funding of the Yellow Fruit USAP. So, you know, if we're tossing ideas around and kind of thinking, hey, did Lou retire as director of NPMS to basically spearhead TTSA in a civilian role? we have seen these sort of staged retirements before with Yellowfruit. And furthermore, what's interesting is once he went on to TTSA, Lou was liaison to the National Reconnaissance Office, National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, and other cabinet level agencies and services and so forth. And that is something to think about and talk about. So we'll probably circle back around to that, okay? Because there's quite a bit there. And I also want to talk more once we touch on the putoff interview. But let's talk about the UAPDF event as well, because, Kerm, I'm sure you watched it.
Yeah, I will say the audio was terrible. Watching it on the live broadcast, it was like whole questions. Like, I just didn't even hear the response to some of like Burleson and Carson's questions.
Yeah. Okay. So Rob, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, like, one of the main things that I found later after the fact, after talking to event staff that were there and like staffers in the building, is that, to my understanding, and I could be wrong here, is that there was an actual wiring problem with the mics at the stand that has to do with that being a very old building. And so that's unfortunate and could have been avoided in other ways and will be avoided in other ways in the future. But aside from that technical issue, I thought it was a fantastically well done event. They did a great job of getting everybody in there who deigned to show up, Senator Gillibrand, as well as some others. You know, the staff, the volunteers who put that event together, like specifically Lester Nair, who's a friend of mine, did a fantastic job, like a really, really fantastic job, because trying to organize an event like that with lawmakers is literally impossible. It is herding cats, but the cats all have jetpacks and they have guns. What I mean by that is that it's impossible to catch them, and almost always it's an effort to try and get them to agree with whatever you want, because they have leverage at all times. So the fact that they got all those lawmakers in there and they did show up within a relatively short period of time was awesome. Although it was a very stressful day for me, because I have to play the same game in my own respect. So,
yeah, I got to echo your sentiments. Huge shout out to Lester Nare. He was able to put everything together and make it run smoothly. Let's go through event or talk by talk and talk about what we thought of the panels. That's okay, Rob. First off was obviously Representative Burleson, Representative Luna, and at times Representative Carson, just talking about the current day disclosure process. Mm-hmm. And I think this is something really pertinent to talk about, because in my opinion, at least, Burleson is really leading the charge for disclosure initiative with Dave Grush and doing the best work. So what do you guys think of that first talk?
I thought wonderful. It was great. I thought it was wonderful. I feel like we have a lot of these events, you know, and it felt like it was kind of in the same vein as kind of previous ones, but it's growing. It's growing more and more. And also to hear the representatives as well, like, make the statements. And then also, like, Luna saying that they were going to grant amnesty as well, or they were talking about immunity protections. Like, that was very impactful. Like, it wasn't just a bunch of fluff and filler and, oh, hey, we're interested in this thing and vote for me. It was like, they're actually doing something about it. So hearing about that was, gave me some hope.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about amnesty, because I know Rob's had some strong opinions on that in the past. And also, I see some comments about Tim Burchett. He had prior obligations. He regrettably couldn't show up. And, you know, that stinks. He would have made a great addition, but he actually had prior commitments. But amnesty, there's a lot of discussion about basically giving temporary NDA waiving for first-handers within the legacy programs or may have been exposed and forced to sign non-disclosure agreements, as well as amnesty for individuals who may have committed crimes at the behest of the legacy apparatus. So, Rob, you've expressed some strong opinions before. How has your viewpoint changed? How does it remain the same kind of with this latest amnesty push?
I don't know. I really don't know. I think that amnesty is probably going to be required at a certain point. But I, like Representative Burleson has espoused, am a fan of, if they have to do that, and I wasn't a fan of amnesty to begin with, because I would like to see people actually prosecuted for crimes. I realize now, having gotten into this as much as I am, that it's unlikely that you can unravel the entire national security state in one fell swoop, and that some degree of amnesty is going to be required. So like our Representative Burleson has advocated for, that 60-day window is probably the most I would be willing to swallow. And if you don't come forward in that 60-day window, and to be clear, a lot of the big guys will not do that. If you don't come forward in that 60-day window, at which point I would want to see all of the evidence and all of the testimony from all of the guys that you've granted amnesty utilized in sort of a RICO case style fashion, where you build a case against every one of these individuals and take them down for everything they're worth. Because they do feel like they're above the law, in my opinion.
So. Yeah, that's well said. In my opinion, the amnesty clause kind of has to be inserted within that 60-day window. There's going to be a lot of individuals who may have an interest in making protected disclosures or disclosures in a classified setting about their involvement in the legacy programs, but there might be a lot of trepidation for a crash retrieval operator who may have inappropriately detained civilians, or there may be some individuals who worked finance on the programs who may have cooked some books and conducted some crime.
Inappropriately detained civilians is a very nice way of saying that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of discussion of kinetic strike between crash retrieval operators and either blue forces or civilians, both of which myself and Mr. Coulthart are aware of, and they're extremely disturbing. But for the boots on the ground operators, I don't think a lot of them will give testimony unless there is that specific amnesty so they can freely give their disclosures without worry.
Mm-hmm. But it can't drag on for forever. Like, this has to be set to a fixed time frame. Like, we can either do this the easy way or the hard way. At this point, I think like a legislative, like at least the Senate definitely has a lot of the data and information. So from there, it's like, okay, well, if you're not going to play ball, like, you are now liable for criminal prosecution. Like, it's now or never.
This is why I respect. Go ahead, Rob.
I was just going to say that, like, it has to be a window no matter what, because if it's not a window, then it just becomes this inordinate thing where, oh, well, I can get amnesty for these crimes. Let me go do my crimes and then show up to the confessional like I'm at church.
Mm-hmm. And different agencies and services and elements of our government have had a chance to press on this issue before. From 2017 to 2023, like you talked about with the Senate Kerm, Senator Gillibrand and once Senator Rubio have quite a bit of information on this topic, including a plethora of hostile witnesses or mob bosses. Furthermore, early last year in 2025, Dave Grush sat down with Arrow, and he said this, providing a list of hostile witnesses or witnesses that need to be interviewed or interrogated to Arrow, and Arrow has yet to follow up on those. So it's interesting that a couple services have clearly not followed up on some of these mob bosses. Do you really think in a 60-day window, Lieutenant General James Clapper is going to be one of the first through the door, or Steve A. Cantrell, or possibly even Terry Phillips out at Northrop Grumman, who's making an absolute killing? Do you think these guys are going to be the first through the door, the actual program workers who may have been a corporate program security officer, a government side program security officer, a PSO? These are the type of people that will probably come in right away. I know individuals that would speak if their NDAs are waived, and these were just guys who were exposed to the programs in official capacities but were forced to sign non-disclosure agreements. Now, something that kind of throws a monkey in the wrench here is I do think there will be people who think twice about delivering testimony if Mr. Elizondo is the czar. There will probably be people who are fearful of delivering testimony if they think their testimony is going to make it through classified channels to Mr. Elizondo, who, at least in my opinion, and I say this confidently, does have a history in program protection. It gets kind of muddy there. Also, the interrogatives. We heard Burleson touch on those more, and I think right now that that's kind of the best foot forward we have right now in the disclosure process. He talked about, Burleson spoke about another entity receiving a set of letters. Do you guys remember what he talked about?
I do remember what he talked about. I don't. Did he mention the entity? Because I don't recall. Okay, cool. I'm aware of some other entities receiving interrogatories as well through sources and channels. It's an exciting time, but it does, again, take time for those to come back. Isn't that like a 60-day time window they have to respond to that?
Yeah, and also some of the letters are nicely worded. So, for example, the MITRE Corporation letter is now public. If you see the individual who was the letter was sent to, I believe his name is Christopher Land or Christopher Ladd, Christopher Larda. I'm just messing up right now.
Right.
He joined MITRE at the beginning of the year. So that was a very, very, very good trade craft by, I assume, Dave Grush and Burleson to basically, you know, pinpoint the new guy or some weak links in MITRE, say, hello, we know these are the materials you have. You are legally compelled to deliver classified testimony by this date. And this is a preservation act. If you destroy any materials, we will know, and you will be prosecuted for that.
Well, get that established hopefully he's not a crappy employee and he doesn't forward it up the chain or something. I mean, that is interesting to hear. And also hope I was also going to say, yeah, if the MITRE letter is any indication of what was sent to Patel, if I was Patel, I'd probably be peeing and pooping my pants right now. Cause there's like a whole page just on like a literally audit and financial record preservation. Like there's a whole section to that dot, like dedicated to that in the MITRE letter. Like the preservation order is like, it's very thorough, which, it's awesome.
I also think a lot of these letters are well written. The letters aren't necessarily going right after the contract or the entity, right? The Preservation Act is basically saying, hey, you know, we don't need you to tell us the specific chain of command of why records may have been destroyed, why they may have been moved, or if there was like a weird skirting chain of command. We just want these records and you're legally compelled to do so. It's not asking like the MITRE Corporation or other entities to basically rat out their government customer, which a lot of the time would be for MITRE specifically, the Navy and Army, mostly the Navy. So I think those are well worded. And right now I think we're seeing the carrot. Who knows if we have to move to the stick at any point, but again, there's a big monkey wrench in here where we might have a challenging a future with some of these disclosure efforts with Mr. Elizondo at the helm.
So I'm curious your thoughts on this, Gerb, with particularly with MITRE, because I remember from Ross's podcast with Eric Burleson on Fresh Freedom, he was talking about how he was aware of MITRE, I think, being involved in the more like gate psionic kind of level activity. I don't know if you guys caught that part of his remarks, but I'm curious what you think of that, and then also like if your data kind of leads towards those possibilities.
I do think MITRE has an interest in some of those more strange mental phenomena, but my knowledge on MITRE is all about some crazy stuff in terms of actual legacy program tracking, monitoring, collection, exploitation, mm-hmm. and exactly what's in my wheelhouse. I'd say the MITRE is the big bad FFRDC in that case.
Interesting.
I'm not familiar with the background intelligence on that. I haven't been briefed into that or read into that here at News Nation. So I can't really say. I'll leave that to my boss on that one. I know a lot of his stuff, but not that.
Well, if you could get a briefing, I suggest that. But I wanted to at least ask that because he made that specific call out and comment of like Northrop, they have a separate program, which I think ties mm-hmm. back to your mm-hmm. research.
Yeah.
And then MITRE, and then someone else as well that he mentioned like had a very specific like set of the activity, if you will.
Right. And I don't think at all MITRE has embarked on their own program. MITRE is one of the centralized pillars to the actual U.S. government-sponsored legacy program. And, you know, I'll explain more about this over time just because this is such a passionate topic of mine of FFRDCs and semi-private institutions. But the way in which MITRE was constructed and other entities are so integral to U.S. government R&D. Now, like you said about Northrop Grumman, yeah, what I've talked about before is that in 2005 specifically, Northrop Grumman got a little upset with some GWAT money, Global War on Terror money, that was going to the legacy program that eventually got re-diverted to the GWAT. Northrop said, hey, we can misappropriate our own funds with IRAD. We can cook our own books and we can self-fund some activities. We have the infrastructure. We have some of the personnel with the knowledge to do so. And we have the locations to do that. And indeed, they did that and started doing some really weird things.
That was a banger video when I watched it. That was like a couple months ago, wasn't it? That was a this year release.
Yeah. And that's all just to say that at least from what I've been exposed to, and I'm super confident in saying this, that the actual legacy program structure is so convoluted and complex that, you know, when we're talking about the UAP czar, Lou might be really well in tuned with National Security Council programs and how those date back. But in terms of how in the 80s and onwards, the programs were really scattered into the wind, buried in cover programs and offices and purposefully hidden to avoid standard oversight channels. I think Dave Grush is the only man with the actual ability to kind of peer across these silos and piece together some patchwork. I mean, how are you supposed to how are you supposed to transition oversight of the National Security Council portfolio, but also reach out to Terry Phillips, Vice President for Security at Northrop Grumman, and some of his compatriots and say, hey, you know, your program that you've been running for over 20 years at this point, where you have collected, exploited, and stored your own craft that is not accountable to your original government handler, the CIA, you're back working for the U.S. government. So it takes a man with real leadership skills to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I would just think it would take somebody with the balls to say the moment they had authority over, you know, let's say a portion of the legacy program run by the U.S. government, you have to assume you also at that point, if you have that authority, you have the authority to potentially task JSOC units. So when Mr. Terry Phillips says, well, no, I'm not going to give this back to you, say, oh, okay, JSOC will come take it.
Yeah, and how do you silence some of the real nasty program protection and program exposure elements, such as the DARPA Security Intelligence Directorate, such as the AFOSIPJ? I mean, remember what David Grush recently said on the Judicial Watch podcast and the Megyn Kelly podcast? When he filed his ICIG complaint, before he went public, the Air Force tried to place him under criminal investigation. He's mentioned like several occasions in which this happened. That man doesn't step a toe out of line. I see some comments saying, you know, Dave Grush has expounded on some new information. Why is that? It's because he can do so now without going to jail. When Dave Grush is able to say information, he is the only officer or former senior within the U.S. armed forces or intelligence community that is completely candid with the information he's been exposed to. And I think that's really important to kind of realize going forward.
Yeah, and when people wonder, it's probably worth clarification here, and I'm not even sure if I should say this, but I'm going to say it out loud. When Dave goes to say something, he gets approval to say that. Like, he does not, like you said, he doesn't step out of line. So that includes like the DOPSR process as well, like that he's had to go through for several things that he's gotten permission to say. So it's, you know.
And you have
to, what my point is there is just that, like, he jumps through the hoops. He jumps through every hoop that he has to.
And you have to think about why, too. Remember all the way back to 2023, where he talked about when he filed his complaint, even before so, when he was kind of investigating the topic within the U.S. intelligence community and armed forces channels, he was subject to horrific administrative terrorism and threats to both himself and his family. And I think one of the most powerful things he said back in 2023 is he discussed some of his colleagues that received disgusting reprisals for even coordinating or speaking with Dave. And he said that, you know, at the end of the day, he's there to represent those people. So he's just trying to do as much as he can by the books while actually being an American patriot, which I think just must be commended. Him and Burleson are doing incredible work right now.
Yeah. And it's an incredibly like tough line to like walk as well, especially when dealing with a lot of this stuff. It's it's commendable. So there's very few people I can trust. Grush is at the top of my list, I would say.
Yeah, remember when Dylan Borland testified last year? He's talked about since that before he gave testimony, he didn't have approval or disapproval for what he could say, and he had already had threats leveraged at him of treason, of espionage. So when I met him for the first time in person at the stage, he was visibly shaking because he was so scared if he said one wrong thing, he would be persecuted or possibly met with some pretty severe reprisals.
Dylan's a good guy as well. I mean, a lot of, what those guys go through on the inside, it's unimaginable. And especially when you're being threatened with like the Espionage Act, which carries the death penalty, like that's got to turn your gut in a way that I've never experienced before in this life. And frankly, I don't want to experience it, but I feel extremely sorry for those that have.
Yeah. Fast forwarding to kind of the end of UAPDF, and then we can go back. There was a monetary pledge to Dylan Borland and Matt Brown's Vanguard Enterprise in which they're attempting to help whistleblowers. So that was really cool to see. And
yeah.
I hope these guys can kick some butt and actually get some action going, because both of those guys have been through quite a bit.
Yeah.
It was actually really special. So a lot of the UAPDF, I was hanging out with Matt Brown and Dylan Borland, and we got to walk through the Senate halls where, you know, Dylan had to go deliver testimony at one point. And it was kind of cool and also a bit harrowing to see those gentlemen kind of relive some of their experiences where they didn't know if their future was going to be all right when they were delivering testimony and specific disclosures. So that was cool to see. Also, Jeff Nusitelli was there, and he's a great guy, if any of you have interacted with him as well.
Yeah, no, he's a fantastic guy. I had the pleasure of really hanging out with him for the first time out of contacts in the desert last month. And then again, you know, here in town, he's now local to the area, to my understanding. So I see him around here and there. He's a great guy.
So if I'm trying to remember who was on after some of the Congress folk, was it the National Security Council panel featuring Mellon, Marek von Rennenkamp, Kirk McConnell, and others?
Was it? So believe it or not, I can't answer that question for you. So to clarify, I loved this event. I got to experience about an hour and 20 minutes of it on Thursday. It was unfortunately 90% of what I had to do that day was running back and forth between the studio. So I gotta go back and watch more than likely.
I think it was. And okay, I think some of the best comments actually came from Kirk McConnell. He made some great, Kerm's going to love this because this is one of his favorite statements. Somebody made a comment about triangles. I think it was the panel moderator. I can't quite remember. Each panel member, Marek, Chris Mellon, talked about triangles. And Kirk actually kind of went out on a limb. Remember, he was a staffer for SSCI and really investigated this topic from 2017 to 2023, actually meeting with witnesses, actually collecting testimony in classified settings. He said, yeah, I think these triangles, the triangles are ours. And I know Kerm's going to love that because he has a really nice TR-3B made for him by our friend Wagboss, which is an awesome model. That's so cool.
It's sitting right here. Oh my gosh. Yes. It's the TRL-33 or TR Lee. It's based off the Dukes of Hazzard, if you've ever seen that movie. Yes. No, I did watch the broadcast when Kirk was talking about that. And when I watched that broadcast, it made me think of the, like, I think it was like a 23-minute long video that's like allegedly in the vaults that like shows one of these black triangles coming out of the water. So I know the data's out there, but yeah, I've always thought that the triangles were kind of ours. Like I don't know if there's any cases where it's like, well, it's a genuine unknown, but it's a triangle. It seems like they're always human made.
I think it depends on the time epoch. Cause I was with you, Kerm. I've come to kind of discount the special operations manual, the Majestic 12 document. I think now that that's probably passage material. And that of course talks about non-human intelligence triangle sightings. But I think the owner and maker of the triangle really depends on the time epoch. And also like the size of the triangle, if that makes sense. From individuals like Ed Fouché and quite a few others, it seems like some of the man-made triangular platforms range in 100 to 300 feet quite often. And on my channel, I've covered a USO retrieval case in the early 90s off the coast of Aberdeen, Scotland, that I do think happened by the crew of a DSSV, deep submergent search vehicle. The triangle that was pulled up was between the size of an F-14 and 50 feet. So quite small. It had crazy, really weird glyphic writing along the side. It had no rivets, of course, no cockpit, exactly what we'd come to expect. Mm-hmm. And I think based upon that crash retrieval encounter, that was a non-human intelligence triangle. There's also in one of the recent tranches of files, there is one document from the 1950s that discusses a CIA officer observing a triangle. I believe this was in Soviet-controlled territory. He saw a triangle about the size of an F-14 again, slowly rotating over a Russian field before that took off vertically at incomprehensible speeds. And I personally am not at the place where I can say that the Soviets had triangles in the early 1950s.
Did anyone even have working craft in the 1950s? I mean,
I don't believe so.
I need to go back and look at that specific file. I don't think I saw that in the this was in Tranche 3?
I believe it was Tranche 3, yeah.
Okay.
I don't believe so. I think most of the tech breakthroughs occurred in about the year 1957 to 1960. I think there was a reason why you see so many FFRDC stood up in 1957 to 1960, mainly the Aerospace Corporation and MITRE. I strongly believe at the 10-year anniversary of Roswell, there was a re-evaluation of some of the holdings there at Wright-Patterson. And that's when some more, not airframe derivation programs, but specifically technology exploitation and derivation programs were started. And there are some really interesting ones that I do plan to talk about in the future, but they have that 10-year reevaluation of materials.
Right. And just for the viewers who don't understand what a technology derivation and exploitation program might be, that in layman's terms is we're figuring out individual small portions of the technology and then integrating that into a more conventional airframe.
Yep. And that's completely irrespective of Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso, right? You know, a lot of people see him as pretty controversial because of his book, The Day After Roswell, which had a lot of extra information put into it by the co-writer at the time. But Corso, this is even irrespective of Corso's manuscript, Dawn of a New Age, which is much better. And Rob, even more so than just airframes, technology derivation to U.S. defense systems. And I just think there's a reason why you could look at, you know, 1960 and the MITRE Corporation being set up in that time. There's some interesting elements there. What else did Kirk say, Kern? Because he actually, I think, in my opinion, he had the best statements from that panel.
Yeah. I know he's talked a little bit about like the behind closed doors proceedings with the firsthand witnesses. I know he's talked about that a little bit at Seoul before. A lot of the things that he talked about, I had heard previously, like either at the Seoul discussion or some of his other speaking parts. I will say that the triangle part was pretty interesting. I don't really have any kind of other comments other than that. I don't really have much to yap on.
Oh, there was discussion, of course, so much discussion about the Nimitz encounter, because that's a lot of people's favorite cases, including it was Mellon's favorite case and Marek's favorite case. Ross and I talked about this in News Nation, Rob, so I'm not going to give my perspective here, but there still is a debate raging on to this day whether the Tic Tac was truly a non-human intelligence vehicle, was a reproduction vehicle, or a non-human intelligence vehicle that was currently being operated by humans. What is your guys' take? And I'm going to save that for Ross.
I think that all three of those are so firmly on the table that unless I knew the insider information about that, I really couldn't make a determination. I would probably lean towards like non-human intelligence technical vehicle being operated by a third-party contractor.
Yeah, I'm kind of there. My mind goes to the Condor Man article where he talks about like Kavorite and the process of like building this stuff and having kind of two endpoints for this propulsion system. That makes sense to me in my monkey brain. So, and then also, of course, you know, Big Dog Ross saying that he knows categorically that the vehicle was made by Lockheed Martin. So I have no reason to negate or otherwise debunk Big Ross's claim here, but I'd like to see some evidence.
Rob, can I ask? I was going to say, can I ask you, because you're Ross's right-hand man. He loves and respects you. I've seen that firsthand, how much he values your opinion, how much he values your direction and input on things. Have you and he talked about this information? Because, of course, to this day, Ross still gets quite a bit of both flack and questions on this topic.
So, yeah, we talked about it really briefly at one point when I was giving – I was giving him crap about it. And he pushed back a little and said that he would, you know, discuss it with me further at when we had the opportunity. We just legitimately haven't had the opportunity while he was here. Thankfully, I'm probably going to SCU with him in Toronto in about a month. So I'll have the opportunity to have a lot more in-person conversations shortly. But I want to be clear. Ross hired me because I'm willing to push back on him. I'm willing to tell him, no, I think that's bullshit, Ross. And he enjoys that. He needs someone around him who's willing to do that. And that's my job. So,
yeah, I mean, like I was saying, I've seen firsthand. I think you're great for Ross because he has so much coming at him with stories and sources and information. I think sometimes it can be hard to vet that and, you know, platform the best voice or platform the best show. And I think you're the guy to kind of help filter through to get the best stories. Do you guys have any awesome guests lined up or other videos outside of myself and Mike Gold for a reality check that you're planning on doing that you can share, of course?
Well, I mean, we have an upcoming interview with Representative Burleson, which we filmed in studio. In terms of future videos, I can't really say. I know that we have a couple things that we're working on that might involve a little bit of travel to film. But again, those have to be kept under the hood until we're ready for that story to be, you know, revealed. You know, somebody could always fly out and do it before us. So.
What was the next talk after the national security panel? Do you guys remember?
No, unfortunately, I had to run to the studio at that point.
Was it not the Vanguard discussion? Or
that was very last. Matt and Dylan came on the last second.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, full disclosure, I was working while this conference was going on, so I was kind of in and out on terms of my like covering it live.
Well, yeah. Ooh, I'd like to address a comment in the chat really quickly. Please. Scrums, one of our moderators, mentioned that the Tic Tac being ours is at odds with the Flag Admiral and the Nimitz CAG not knowing what the hell it was and sending emails Navy-wide. Pardon me. I would say that's not necessarily true, specifically because the allegation that is being operated by Lockheed Martin without the express authority of, you know, the United States Navy, not necessarily putting out NOTAMs or anything like that, and possibly, you know, doing some red team testing against them. I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility if it's being operated by a corporation that we know from other pieces of evidence has little to no regard for what's legal or not legal when it comes to certain things.
Yeah, I think that's well said. Well, I'm kind of having a knowledge gap in what occurred after that platform as well. Dylan Borland and I took a walk around the Senate building. He and I think we've both been feeling super jaded about some of the stuff just kind of going on with Lou, this position, with some of the council stuff, the governance board. So we kind of needed to clear our heads there because I don't know about you guys, but I've been feeling a little bit jaded. So maybe we could also talk about the council and the governance board because we have yet to talk about that yet. I might have a little bit more information there, of course, because I actually did sit down with Avi Loeb and you know asked him if this was going to be another Robertson panel and so forth. So especially after hearing the council and governance board spoken about at UAPDF, what are your guys' current thoughts? And also, Rob, tell us about the governance board and council.
I mean, I don't know exactly everything I can tell you about the governance board and council. I know that I've met several members of it recently. It is a right now there is a science advisory board that exists, which is the presidential UAP science advisory board, which is the one that we're generally referring to. But this board is a satellite board to a larger governance council that's being established within the executive branch. Exact details on that, I can't really give you because I don't have them. But as those emerge, obviously that will be a focus of reporting for us as much as we can. As it stands, you know, I'm familiar with a number of members that are on the science advisory board, not including, I'm sorry, but including, you know, Dr. Loeb, a few others, their communications director, who's a close friend of ours. You know, I think that they're going to go into this with the intent to do good science. I don't know, and this is just my personal opinion, I don't know whether that that internal executive governance board is going to allow them enough data to draw great conclusions from yet. I don't know. I hope so. But we'll see. And I remain pretty optimistic just based on what I've seen. I do think that having a skeptic on the board like Shermer can actually be a good thing too. I think that while he was very rude in his approach, and certain people with large academic egos tend to be that way until they're called out on it, I think that that could eventually be a positive thing. But again, the jury is out on that until we see more results from it. And until we see those results, we also don't have to get mad at them either.
Kerm?
Yeah, I basically the same thing. Although I will say that I am at least more hopeful this time for the UAPDA, or at least more legislation coming out this year, especially just reading the room now with this executive board. You can make the case that like maybe Trump isn't all on board with this, or he doesn't support, whatever the case may be. I think that there's like good legislative ground game that's being played right now. That's important. That's going to continue to grow. I'll believe it when I see it. I think with this council here, I think the way that it was kind of rolled out within the UFO community was a bit odd, I will say. I have no comments really on who's on the board. I think it's a lot of good picks. These are people that I think I would have on my executive council if I was running the show, but they don't put me in charge of anything. So yeah, I'd like to see more come out of it, but also I can't understand why this was not announced like officially. I think there were some people that were like, oh, well, this isn't official because the White House hasn't posted anything about it. But to be frank, the way the White House has been posting about anything like outside just in general, like I don't want them memeing this. I don't want them memeing my intellectual special interest. So I'm glad that they didn't go that route. But I would like to see more action on this front, and I'd like to see more leadership.
Yeah, I agree with both of you guys. Let's give it time and give it a fair shake. I still have concerns that there's going to be agency or legacy program sponsored conclusions, just like the Robertson panel in 1969 Condon Committee and Arrow, where, you know, nothing to see here, guys. What does worry me about the council, not the governance board, but specifically the council, because we know more about the council than the overall governance board, is the members don't have access to classified information, even LES or law enforcement sensitive information. So at the UAPDF, Admiral Gallaudet, who is an awesome guy, I really like him as a person, he's a great guy. He was speaking about the council and he said, this was actually kind of a cool shout out. It was kind of an honor. He said that during his admiralship, he was never briefed on NURO, the National Underwater Reconnaissance Office, which, you know, makes sense. It said there's the big five intelligence agencies. Yeah, there's six. The National Underwater Reconnaissance Office, the Navy and CIA's counterpart to the NRO is one of those. It's an unacknowledged intelligence agency. He said that during his time within the Navy, he was never briefed into NURO. So because of some conversations he and I have had, and because of some of my work, he wanted to use the council to pry into NURO. So if you're kind of bridging the gap to use NURO records to maybe look into USO crash retrievals, how is this council going to access, for one, NURO records, but also like NURO operations with SUPSALV, the superior of salvage and a supervisor of salvage and diving, I'm sorry, and those sort of classified records. So I think it's a very tall order for the council to get access to real good data sets. Also, as we kind of know with Immaculate Constellation and other legacy adjacent sensor and tracking data, pretty much the good data is siphoned off by the NGA and other combat support agencies. So where are you going to get good data sets of really good overhead imagery of UFOs? One of the things that Avi said in our podcast with Hal Putoff and Burleson that I do hope he reevaluates, because this is concerning to me, is he kept saying that he wants to leave the past behind and look to the future, essentially wording things so they wanted to leave past data sets in the behind. I think that's monumentally a bad idea. I still think that some of the unknown unknowns all the way back from Project Blue Book are still worth evaluating for such councils. So, if somehow this makes its way to Avi or their comms director, I really hope that point's reevaluated, because I under no circumstances think that previous day sightings and imagery and data should be discarded.
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of concerns with like what type of sensor data they'll have access to. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the only thing that I'll say is that the fact that they're not going to be dealing with classified information could also be taken as a positive, in the sense that it could potentially indicate, and there's nothing to say that this is the case yet, but I'm playing devil's advocate here. It could potentially indicate a greater willingness to declassify data in order to give it to them, which could be a very good thing. So my main stance on the Science Advisory Council right now is that everybody gets a good 90 days to start their job before you start judging them. And I'm going to give them that benefit of the doubt. So.
Yeah, I hope that somehow the overhead of this effort, which decisions were made for the governance board and council up at the White House level, at the administration level, I do hope this mm-hmm. doesn't tie into the UFO's czar position. I would be very concerned with the sort of data. And that's not to comment on the individual members of the council, but, you know, the overhead and the kind of oversight mechanism for that council, I'd be concerned there.
Yeah, and we will likely not know what that oversight mechanism is. So that's a little bit of a mystery, but yeah, it is what it is. I do think that on the positive end here is that Dr. Loeb is very well respected within the administration. They very much like him. Sometimes what's the term? Honey attracts more flies than something else. I don't know.
Honey attracts more flies than vinegar.
There you go. Thank you.
Can we talk a little bit about the Hal Putoff conversation? Because it was pretty interesting, and there might be some good stuff. So like I said at the beginning of the stream, we had way less people. So I think there's like 1,000 people here that this might be new to, is mm-hmm. that a lot of the podcast was talking about OSAP, ATIP, et cetera. And some of the things I've talked about in my videos all the time is that the Kona Blue Perspective Special Access Program transfer from Lockheed Martin to AUSAP involved materials or bulkhead or piece of craft from the 1953 Kingman, Arizona crash retrieval. Hal Putoff obtusely confirmed this to me. Basically, I poked and prodded because I said I was aware independently that these materials were from Kingman, and he nodded at me and didn't really say anything. So that was interesting to me. What was fun talking about to Putoff, I did get him to confirm, and I think this is on record, I'm trying to remember because so much went on, that ATIP wasn't a real program and that AUSAP was. And that ATIP was just kind of attached to AUSAP in a different kind of unofficial capacity. So I think that's really important that somebody who was actually on AUSAP officially said that.
Yeah.
So we do have him confirming that. I also talked to Hal Putoff, and this was off air. I don't remember if it was on air, but I told him, do you not think it's concerning that in the Age of Disclosure documentary, you are listed as an ATIP scientist? You and Dr. Davis are listed as ATIP scientists, not AUSAP scientists, because we know ATIP's not a real program and AUSAP was. And he didn't know about that. You know, he's a fossil, guys. He's so old. I don't think he watched the documentary, but, you know, that was really concerning to him.
Was he not at the premiere in Austin when Eric Davis had that thing on? Eric Davis had a crazy fit for that. I remember that.
I bet he probably fell asleep. I think he was.
Huh.
Yeah, no, he was there. I remember him in the photos.
But, you know, even that being said, I don't have full trust of Putoff. I definitely think he was involved at least tangentially to the legacy programs and thus is subject to quite a few non-disclosure agreements. And so I don't think we're necessarily getting the full story always from Putoff, but these sorts of statements were interesting. Can I get your guys' overhead view of Putoff before kind of I go any further with this interview?
My high-level view of Putoff is that there's almost a certainty that Putoff either attempted to get into the program or succeeded in getting into the program at some point in his career. In what capacity, I do not know. But I would say that absolutely he was involved in the program in some way, shape, or form. He shows up in too many places, in too many books, in too many meetings, in too many, you know, roles. I don't know. It's hard to look at the body or the corpus of evidence and not draw that conclusion. But again, I also can't tell you exactly what Hal Putoff did. So,
besides Stargate, of course, and some of the
Putoff scares me a little bit because not only do you have the UFO stuff, but he was absolutely 100% part of Stargate. So it's like big dog. Like what kind of level of access or ball knowledge does this guy have? Like, why does the U.S. government make him like the secret space scientist, essentially, you know?
And like I always talk about this, we have to consider this what Dave Grush said on Rogan, which was some of the Psi programs were started as a way to figure out how to unlock some of the technology we have sitting in a hangar somewhere. So if Hal Putoff is spearheading some of the RV programs and like psychic programs and remote viewing programs, is there a crossover that he might have thought this was, or he would have been the man to help crack open some of these craft we had sitting? So that's always very interesting to me.
I mean, what I also find interesting about Dr. Putoff is that in the late 1960s, he joined the Church of Scientology on purpose in order to try and learn more about their operating Thetan levels and things like that. And he very quickly advanced all the way to OT7, which is operating Thetan level 7, which is a relatively big mark for your advancement within their community. So I wonder what all he did there, what he took away from that, and whether or not that affected anything he did moving forward.
What's a Thetan, Rob? I don't know too much about Scientology.
I'm so glad that you asked, and I'm going to butcher this. If anybody's really a Scientology like nerd in the comments, I am probably going to butcher this explanation. But essentially, a Thetan is essentially a thing that is attached to your soul inside of you. How do I say it? I think I'm doing this the wrong. I'm explaining this incorrectly. A Thetan is basically like the thing that's inside of you that's you, because your soul moves on to like additional bodies like every time you die on this planet, specifically because it's almost like a prison planet mythology. But I don't want to get too deep in their lore.
Okay, well, we don't have to then. Putoff was, he, like I said at the beginning, he was a pleasant person to talk to, as was his wife. His wife was lovely.
Yeah.
And I, based upon my takeaways with him, because we talked about the NDA waiving, it's still unclear to me if NDAs were waived, if he would actually deliver testimony. You know, you got guys like Eric Davis. Most of his sources is a four-star general who brute forced his way a read on into the program. That's real, as far as I understand. That's very real, and that's very interesting. As well as a longtime vice president at TRW. Those, as far as I understand, are Dr. Davis's primary sources. You know, Eric Davis has said so many times that if NDAs are ever waived, he'd be the first one to go squeal into the president or deliver classified testimony. So I'm still unsure if Putoff would do that. Somebody said in the comments that if you were to crack him open, the amount of secrets he could reveal, I'm sure he knows quite a bit. The biggest takeaway from this interview is I think we got a lot more actionable information on Kona Blue. I think Kona Blue is one of the most important events in the kind of recent history of the legacy program, especially because institutions like Arrow tried to cite that Kona Blue was why true believers like Dave Grush cited that the legacy program existed. No, we do now have an individual involved, Hal Putoff, talking about, you know, Lockheed Martin. He wouldn't name Lockheed Martin specifically, but the contractor divulging actual recovered materials to the OSAP, which is really interesting to talk about, because I know you guys love the Kona Blue saga just as much as me.
It's interesting, and that slide deck is something else.
Yeah, I absolutely can't wait to dive into that interview, because I need all the additional details that are provided about that, because you know that I'm very deep into trying to track where that material went. So
I still think one of the coolest parts about the Kona Blue situation is actually really, really crafty in terms of the Lockheed folks and the OSAP folks. Of course, the Kona Blue Prospective Special Access Program was facilitated through the DHS, Department of Homeland Security's newly created Directorate of Science and Technology, DS&T. As far as I understand, DHS isn't involved in the legacy program. So this was really interesting to me to essentially use neutral territory as a technology transfer agreement body, a TTA. We see this now kind of what I've been talking about too, with getting the DHS involved as a kind of a program lead on getting files reviewed and declassified. It was really ingenious, in my opinion, to involve DHS.
Well, yeah, exactly, because DHS is an upstart organization. It was created as part of the Global War on Terror post 9/11. And so you don't have an institutional history of dealing with these programs. So it's basically a fertile field for you to lay this down and create a new within the oversight structure program that deals with the subject. And that's almost precisely why it was killed.
It makes sense for the same reasons why you would send it to the new guy at MITRE, that interrogatory letter too, right? Same, like they don't have the context, they don't understand, but it's like, hey, you got to do this thing, big dog, and if you don't, your ass is grass.
Right.
Yeah, and again, among some of the parties that shut this down were CIA, DS&T, Directorate of Science and Technology elements like Glenn Gaffney, the real relayer of information here, Mary Sturtevant. Rob's done some incredible work on Sub Rosa, including Mr. Robert Cardillo, who was head of the NGA, and others. Rob, I know you're making some edits to that article. Are you going to be reposting it in the future?
Potentially. I am going to be working on that all the way up until I fly out at some point to go do an American Alchemy interview regarding it. And then after that, I may post. So
that's a nice little drop. So Rob Jones on American Alchemy coming up.
Yeah. So to full disclosure, I've already filmed with Jesse, and we want to film more to make a larger, like cooler, bigger episode. So we're going to schedule a time to do that sometime this summer. And then maybe in the fall, that'll come out. It'll be a while. Don't hold your breath. So
I got an idea, guys.
What's up?
So for everybody in the chat, we have a ton of questions for a Q&A, but also Kerm has a delicious PowerPoint that he made. So I'm thinking, and if you guys agree with this, we'll start shifting over to the Q&A and do a live here in the next week or two, completely devoted to Kerm's PowerPoint.
Yeah, I think we should. It's a great PowerPoint.
It's very fun, guys. Trust me.
So can you give a pitch about it for next time, Kerm?
Yeah, for sure. So it basically is all the stuff that I'm interested in. So high level, it talks about like auditing concepts, and then the financial like legacy program architecture, and then kind of some initial thoughts therein. Subject to change, because this is an ever-evolving situation. So if the balance sheet does leak, inevitably that will change the presentation. But I do have it ready to go tonight and happy to present it on a separate live stream, as Gerb said, just because it's there's a lot in there. And I think it would be a fun discussion that would take maybe a half hour, 45 minutes, maybe longer than that.
Let's see what the chat
says.
That's
a 45-minute PowerPoint, I'm telling you right now.
I'm being conservative. We can skip through all the boring audit stuff because that's just like, I mean, that's
no, that's what the, that's what the viewers are going to love.
Okay.
It's Rob's call. Do we do it now, Rob, or save it for another time? Yes, it's your call.
What I would say is, Kerm, let's save it for another time and let's devote like a larger block of time to it because I can really only go until about 7:45 or 8. I'd love to do some Q&A. We have a lot of great questions from Discord. We've had a lot of great questions in the chat already that we definitely need to like devote time to. So let's try and blast those out.
So let me go through these super chats. Rob, do you guys have some of the questions saved on your screen to present screen? I'm way too paranoid to ever present my screen.
No. We're not going to present our screen or anything like that. I'm going to read the questions out.
And okay, chat, before y'all lose your minds, the deck is only going to get more granular now. So it's going to become more autistic as a result of this. This is a good thing. Stay tuned. Watch the space.
Let me get through these and then we'll continue to the Q&A. Tumble to Booze, thank you, my friend. I very much appreciate it. And Osanace, thank you for the 5 gifted subs. I'm blessed for you guys. And Tumble to Booze has another question here. And thank you again. Do you think aliens are biblical angels? By extensions, can aliens go through... Can aliens be thought as a god? Thank you for your videos. Thank you. Let Kerm answer this because I'm a straight legacy program guy.
Yeah. So this is something I'm interested in because I am a cradle Catholic. So I'm just going to check my religious bias at the door. But I've actually spoken to a number of men in the cloth actually pretty recently about this subject. And particularly now recently, this whole discussion of like UFOs being demons or angels and like, what does that mean? And what does that mean for disclosure? That's been going on a lot. And it's something that I think about, of course. What I will say is from the people in the church that I've talked to, like priests, deacons, not like anyone of like bishop or, you know, Vatican high level, there's a lot of things going on. God's kingdom is very vast. I kind of point towards Grush's comments, which actually he, I think, articulated it pretty well. Of yes, like God is very much real. That is something that I believe inherently, but I also know that to be a fact. Angels and demons are a part of that, but also there is something else going on. Like, I'll just tell you a story real quick. I was talking to a priest pretty recently who basically told me that his uncle was pretty high up within the Defense Intelligence Agency, and he was read in to a program that was exploiting non-human technology, and his uncle turned down the position. Now, that just came out of the priest unprompted after I asked him, like, oh, are these UFOs things in the news? Is that like, is it demons? Because like, that's in the news cycle. And he's like, big dog, let me tell you real quick. My uncle was asked to work on this stuff. It's something else entirely. So it's not to say that it's not all like BS or not real. I think there's a lot of different things going on. Based on what you believe in, you might call it certain things, but it's not to say that reality is what it is. So it's an interesting world out there.
You got the perfect guy to answer that question, Tumble to Booze, because Kerm is the best of the best representative for Catholics I can think of. So
allegedly, don't put that all on.
No, you're a great, you do the faith in the church.
Pretty sure that title belongs to Jesus, right?
Yes.
Kerm's a great guy. You're the
best.
Many
people before me.
Crypto, thank you. Thank you, evening to you. We've been talking about this all night, but because of that super generous donation, if we didn't answer any aspects of Burleson, Grush, Avi Loeb Council, just ping in the chat and we'll make sure to get back to you because that is so kind. Thank you very much. Rob, you'll like this from David. Shout out to Rob for being an absolute legend. Tell us about Lies Above.
Oh, man. So the account in the chat here, Lies Above, is actually my friend David A. Burkett. He's an excellent, excellent author and a preeminent cybersecurity researcher here in the United States. He's a great guy. We met at SCU about a year and a half ago, and I had the honor of becoming friends with him. And then eventually I helped him edit a book, which he has just released, called Lies Above. And I would call it the definitive primer on the 80-year cover-up of the UFO topic within the United States.
So please check out Lies Above.
Yeah, please check it out. Available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. I believe David's working on a digital copy at some point, but we also have a trailer, a website, a few other things. And if you're ever interested, You can check those out. There's also one of the cool features of the book is that every single source is cited and available to the reader. So when you sit down and you crack open this book, if you have any questions whatsoever about the actual sourcing of the material within the book itself, there will be footnotes, Chicago style, if I'm not mistaken, footnotes with full references, as well as a unique QR code system, which you can scan with your phone and then immediately bring up the source material, whether that's a photograph, a document, a video, a specific podcast appearance, or a specific FOIA release or something of that nature. All of it's routed through the website, so it goes through a secure website, and if those links break, we can fix them later. Dave's a genius for this, and I think it's a cool feature. So
that's really cool.
Rob, could you
Could
you please drop the website in the chat? I think this is, of course, a book that put it in the chat, let people see it, because this is something that folks should support, because that's great work. You guys know how much I love citing sources. So yeah, please drop that in the chat.
Over 1,500 sources completely cited. Oh. I'm sorry, 1,492 sources completely cited. And then I would just have to give this to one of the mods so that they can post it. Mm-hmm. But it's liesabove.com.
Mike or Scrums, if you guys could be so kind, please post that. UX2E, thank you very much. I think we answered this quite a bit. Was Lou Elizondo on the Legacy program? I believe yes. And I believe part of the regret is he has gotten himself in quite a pickle. He's in a real puzzle box like Chris Ramsey used to solve on his first channel. Kind of the amount of half truths, lies, and fake stories, still trying to say ATIP was a program. I believe recently with Jeremy Corbell in their Los Angeles show, he said that ATIP was a sub-SAP, special access program to OSAP. That is demonstrably false. So I believe he's in an unwinnable pickle at this point. And from the start, I think if he was not operating at the behest of a Clapper-led disclosure initiative, things could have been a lot easier, and he could have been a lot more forthcoming with his non-disclosure agreements that he was in the Legacy program, but still done a lot for the community. So I think it's a bit of a pickle. Okay, let's get to these questions. Rob, do you have some of the questions?
Okay, so we do have a couple questions that have been brought up within the Discord. Let me try and pull a couple of these.
And then, guys, if once we get past these questions, if you'll put your questions in all caps, that's how we'll mm-hmm. get to them the best. And yeah, thank you, Rob, for pulling those up. And the Discord, if you guys want to join, Scrums, Mike, Kerm, Rob, they're awesome in there. I haven't had much time mm-hmm. to go on lately just because of my projects and how much I'm doing. But wonderful, guys. It's not money. There's no subscription. So please join. Let me get to one more super chat. Go ahead.
Just as a quick note on the Discord thing, please be kind to our moderators. They do this all for free. If you guys harass the moderators for any reason, you will be immediately banned.
Don't be weird.
I don't have the money to pay them. They're just guys who do this out of the kindness of their heart. Matt James, how often do Mormons BYU grads come up in the alleged Legacy program? Any credible connection to the college Collins elite? Sorry. Gresh's Joe Rogan comments may be curious. I do think that BYU and Mormons are a recruiting pool for the Legacy programs. Kerm and I had a very good discussion about this last time we were in Washington.
Yes, I was going to say, because not to toot my own accounting horn so much, but one of the things BYU is really, really good at is they have a really good business and accounting program. So if you're looking for people that you can trust with like the nation's deepest, darkest secrets and manage an off-books balance sheet activity for a private company or a government entity, you would want to recruit out of BYU. That makes perfect sense. And also, of course, BYU, Mormons in general, they make perfect intelligence agents. They don't drink, they don't smoke, they speak multiple languages because they do missions abroad. Like, they are, of course, if you're the feds, you want them on your team. I would like to see more kind of substantive evidence, but I think what Gerb and I talked about in DC about like the financial architecture and then also having BYU kind of people work in that beat makes a lot of sense.
It's a good question.
There's a known preference for these types of individuals within intelligence circles, so it's not out of the realm of possibility whatsoever, I would say.
Okay,
not to mention that the Mormon faith is also conducive to the extraterrestrial hypothesis in many ways, so
allegedly.
Fire up them questions for us, and there's some good ones, so let's get attacking.
Okay, so there are some pretty decent questions in here. I wanted to bring up one...
Sorry.
I'm sorry, quick. Say that again?
sorry, Jay Smith in the chat. He's asking where I land in Fortnite. Tilted Towers. Next question. Sorry.
That's yeah, for me, it's Shifty Shafts or Tilted Towers if I'm with a group. So
I have never played Fortnite, so I don't know.
Usually in the OG map, if you land Shifty Shafts, you have enough time to pick up like 4 or 5 kills there. You can clean the place up and then go take over Tilted Towers relatively quickly. So, but yeah, exactly. So my first question is, how do you see, this is from Scrums in the chat. I'm going to give him the first one here. How do you see immunity for whistleblowers playing out? Wouldn't just granting immunity for Grush to disclose his entire protected disclosures to SSCI and the ICIG publicly blow the entire thing wide open? Can that happen? I know we addressed this a little bit earlier. The main thing that I wanted to point out here is that just allowing David to publicize or disclose his entire protected disclosures is probably not enough.
Right. You need to build out a human terrain map and an operational terrain map with enough testimony. Dave's testimony should be enough, especially because he has locations. He has specific knowledge on documents, reports, contracting, program numbers, PEOs, PSOs, MRTFBs, whatever. Mm-hmm. And the Senate had plenty of time from 2017 to 2023 to act on the testimony of extremely credible whistleblowers, but failed to do so. So now we need an influx of individuals to create that human and operational terrain map.
Right. And then our next question here is going to be from Rectified. This one's directly for you, Gerb. Neither of us is going to be able to answer this
Rectify
for you.
Is great.
Yeah, Rectify is awesome. So he asks, a while back, you said that you spoke to 2 former Oak Ridge National Laboratories employees who stated there are 2 fully intact craft underground at the site. Have you been able to corroborate this further since then?
No, my views have. So the information I was exposed to there has changed, but still kind of the same, still the same at the same time. One of those sources I do believe was not true after continuing mm-hmm. to vet. However, my understanding still is that Oak Ridge houses craft and materials. So I'll be fully honest. One of those sources there I do think was bunk and untrue and lying after time vetting them. But I'm still confident that the story around Oak Ridge housing craft is very true.
Okay, cool. All right, so this is a question for the group at large. We can all sort of have our different opinions on this. Mm-hmm. Kamara in the Discord asks, do you believe if it's possible that some of the materials and or craft were purposely transferred to particular allied countries that could more easily conceal their existence, could mask the funds more easily, even as a U.S. transfer of funds to that country, and had more freedom to do the research there due to politics, tighter control of the press, etc.?
Do you guys want to take this first?
Well, I would say that it is possible. However, I doubt it. Given the willingness for certain program elements to do illegal things on American soil, I don't think that going somewhere else is necessarily a security increase. That's just my thoughts on the matter. The example given was a place like Israel. Or potentially what I thought of was like England, if we took something over to Great Britain, because they do have very, very tight control over the press there. I think it's somewhat plausible on its face, and the financial transfers aspect of it definitely sort of lights up some of those warning lights. But at the same time, there's a pretty long history, a documented history of Israel not necessarily being given our best and then having to steal it from us and spy on us in order to get that, such as in the case of Jonathan Pollard in the 1980s. It's just one example. So, you know, yes, they do get a lot from the United States. No, they don't get everything. I don't think we would have given them anything like that. That's just my personal opinion. I don't think you let things like that leave U.S. shores for the most part, or U.S., you know, controlled areas once you have it in our possession. So.
Yeah. And I will, just to kind of add my take or my kind of general observation based on like listening to, you know, random podcasts and conferences with like Air Force generals and whatnot, like just links people send me, is that intelligence, like within at least our relationships and our alliances, it flows inwards. There's no information going outwards. So the premise that like we would hand off these vehicles that have been effectively managed and housed within a program managed in the United States, and we're handing it off. That's just like, it's unnecessary risk. Like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And also, it seems that the gripe, especially with like our, you know, our allied agencies and like the UK, Australia, whatnot, is that like that information, it's being sucked up in a black hole sent to the Americans. And they're kind of told, don't you ask about it, because now it's national security, and like sign this paper or whatever the case may be. So I don't know. I don't really buy it. Also, I haven't really heard anything about like specific cases where the US has like transferred either activities, intelligence, craft, assets to like another service. It's typically the other way around. Like the UK, probably like Randlesham Forest, for example, like that is a good call out of like a crash retrieval that happened outside US, but then was brought in. So I don't see it working that way.
Yeah, I agree with both of you guys fully. I think for maybe some paper records for funding from contractors, DISCs, domestic international sales corporations might be used to fudge some funding or keep some funding records offshore. But as far as actual program records, data, materiel, craft, I think that with our Five Eyes partners, there might be temporary FOBs, forward operating bases, to house materials. Like if you have a UFO crash in Indo-PACOM that our Australian Five Eyes partner friends help retrieve, there might be temporary station at Pine Gap or other relevant facilities, but eventually all materiel flows to the U.S. It is having material here in the U.S. is far safer. Like Rob pointed out, there's way more of a security risk having materials outside of the U.S. We also have tremendous infrastructure here in the U.S. to both house craft and transfer craft of materials. You have the Office of Secure Transportation under the DOE and NNSA. That is the perfect, very, 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 very effective method to transfer UFO materials, bodies, records, et cetera, around the country. So no, I think, and I'm extremely confident that if not all UFOs that we can move, that are small enough to move, are here in our possession in the States.
Right. And just to touch on that topic, things that can move and can't move. I made the mistake of making a joke on Twitter about someone getting the location wrong of the too big to move UFO. The only joke I was making is that I tried to bring up that location with Ross, and he told me that that was the incorrect location. That was the only joke I was making. I do not know that location. I don't want to know that location, and I won't answer any questions about it just because I simply don't have the answer. So,
good answer.
That being said, let's get on to the next set of questions.
Yeah. That was a great question, too. See.
Yeah. So for ARVs to be real, and if they use, I'm sorry, I think I'm reading the wrong question. I apologize. Give me one second.
Sounded interesting. Real quick, though. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Just real quick, just because I saw a comment that I didn't technically answer the question of like, are they aliens, UAP angels? Mm-hmm. Okay, real quick. Angels and demons. Angels are part of the kingdom of heaven. That is its own structure, hierarchy, if you will. UAP is like UFO. It's unidentified. We don't know what these things are. Aliens are from outer space. So angels are not from outer space. They're from the kingdom of heaven. That's a different place. So they are not aliens. I'm sorry to burst your bubble if that's where you're getting at, but that's not what I believe. So just want to be clear.
Sounds good. Okay, so I've got a question here from Captain Jack on Discord. Captain Jack asks, hi guys, would you guys be open to the possibility that the UFOs seen soon after World War II were the result of man-made crafts made in the USA by the Legacy Program that were using German scientists who were involved in Hans Kammler's think tank? It is absolutely a fact that Hans Kammler survived the war and he was in U.S. intelligence custody. There is a possibility that they constructed the underground facilities associated with the Legacy Program. So I do have a thought on this right away, that there is only a single document that indicates that Hans Kammler was in U.S. custody, and that's part of the Eisenhower Library. I know other researchers have approached this before. I personally have extreme doubts about this. I don't think that there were anything other than potentially materials that were seized from the Germans with regards to the UAP topic. But that's just my personal opinion. I haven't seen any evidence to suggest that there were any sort of ARV craft or functional ARV craft that might have been like derivative technical vehicles that were, you know, recovered from that regime and brought here, or that those individual scientists did anything more specific than what we already know regarding nuclear weaponry and stuff like that. It's hard to really pin down where specific paperclip scientists went, but, you know, that's just my opinion.
I agree with you fully, Rob. What is fact is that senior Nazi engineers and material scientists mm-hmm. within the TOT organization like Xavier Dorsch were plucked by paperclip for the Air Force's underground plant program, specifically AMC, Air Materiel Command. Mm-hmm. I personally have not seen evidence that the Nazis had fully working airframes. I think there may have been scientists with specific working knowledge, maybe on the recovered Magenta craft, specifically on material science, or maybe propulsion analysis, or just study of materials or the whole structural system. But I would be very surprised if pretty quickly after World War II, with the help of Nazi scientists, we very quickly had alien reproduction vehicles or even derivative aircraft. I think that success probably came in the mid to late 1960s. We started to see proof of concept of actually deploying derivative or exploited technologies in our airframes. But that's a really good question, and I do want to hear from Kerm as well.
Yeah. I mean, I will say I do not necessarily remember the first part of the question. Did it have something to do with like World War II early crash retrievals and observations? I picked up on that much.
I'm sorry. Anyway. Say that again. I apologize. My brain just like completely turned off because I was trying to read chat questions.
No, I get it. There's a lot of things going on, and I was frankly, yeah. I was doing the same thing when the question was getting read. I'm going to need the question reread before I give a more academic response. I apologize.
So let's see. Here's a question. Was OSAP actually a SAP? And if so, how come people can talk so openly about it? OSAP was not a SAP.
It wasn't.
No, and remember that what Harry Reid was trying to do kind of with the OSAP and trying to get some materials out of Lockheed Martin. As we know from Dave Grush on Joe Rogan, Harry Reid was actually trying to make a waived, bigoted special access program for this materiel transfer, which would have been a much more ironclad system than kind of the patchwork cone of blue DHS transfer we had.
Yeah. Okay, great. Let's see. We have a few more questions here. Let me scroll up. Some of these, unfortunately, guys, are a little bit long-winded, and it's hard for me to pull out the actual question from the block of text. So the shorter and more concise your questions are, the better we can answer them. Okay. So this is a good just general question for everybody on the panel here. How do you view the phenomenon at large? Ultra-terrestrial, von Neumann probes, extraterrestrial? Personally, I'm a smattering of all of the above person.
Yeah, I am too. I talked about this with John Michael Godier on Event Horizon, and he's sharp as a tack. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a dream come true to talk about that with him. But I personally think the biggest picture of this planet is that the zookeepers don't care about the animals unless we mess with the enclosure. And the zookeepers are a wide range of beings, from now everybody's favorite term, sentient plasmoids, to actual biological systems sent by an extraterrestrial civilization, to the whole gambit and above.
I think it's a lot of different things going on. I think aliens as a concept is kind of a... I feel like it's been kind of a red herring for decades of like trying to prove that definitively. And I mean, I've met NASA people that like their whole dream was to be able to come into work, and they found evidence of extraterrestrial life. What I have keyed in to is very much like the on Earth stuff. I think the underwater presence, that's something that is a big part of this. Interdimensional, that's something I don't fully understand, and my religious background at times leads me to conclude that these things are demonic, but I'm at least open to see evidence to suggest otherwise.
again, a lot of different things going on. I don't think Men in Black was a documentary. I don't think it's to that level. But long and short, you have at least three or four different major like tech trees or operations where it's like, you know, non-human intelligence all in one silo being managed private, public, and then all these different webs. And like, that's what we're trying to figure out. And it doesn't make sense, I think, from the outside looking in, but, and it's also just challenging too, that like, I am not an experiencer myself, like not to my knowledge. I don't think I've seen anything or, you know, had an experience myself. So it's a challenge for me personally, just like, I think navigating this topic at times, but I'm at least convinced of certain, like, I guess, base facts, or at the very least, like, okay, now that we have an understanding of those facts, like, how can we further prove this and investigate this, which is kind of what's going on in DC and why we're here on the live streams.
You mentioned the ocean. Mm-hmm. So at the same time, one of the elements that I feel like I have really good knowledge and understanding in this topic is also one of the biggest quandaries to me. And that's the presence of several permanent stations within our oceans, of mobile structures that seemingly have smaller structures depart and return to the larger structure. That's something I'm highly confident exists. I have no idea what that is. I have no idea if it's extraterrestrial, if it's always been on this planet, if it's a von Neumann replicator, which is a very possible thing. But I am quite confident that there are permanent underwater stations of NHI, and that 4chan leak thing is a lot of inside baseball.
I'm led to believe that the 4chan whistleblower was a lot of inside baseball. Also just partly because, like, you know, a lot of what he has said has not been like necessarily negated. What I do find it funny is, at least in the way that he phrased some of his comments of like, oh yeah, you're going to come back and you're going to read these posts as we've continue mm-hmm. on, because you're going to find that I'm right about a lot of stuff. And like, I don't really know if he was like batting 1,000 on the laser stuff he was talking about with China, but still, I mean, frustratingly so, like I keep finding myself coming back to his story, because I'm like, there's parts of it that have ended up seeming very plausible, or at the very least, like, I think that there's been some understanding. So yeah, I mean, what a crazy saga that was, because that also happened. I mean, that post went viral within around the same month or so that that Grush came forward as well.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about kind of my knowledge and understanding of those underwater systems in an upcoming video, and I hope that's really cool, because I know we'll talk about that on here.
Oh boy, I'm excited.
Awesome. Cool. So I've got a couple other questions that are lined up here. The very first question I had was Lemat87N in chat says, I want to know, what is one of Gerb's blind spots? What does he want to learn more about? And where are his main uncertainties? I think that question can go for all of us, but if you'd like to start, Gerb.
Sure. So I have a lot of blind spots. As I'll be the first to say, and I always try and stay in the lane I've carved out for myself, my knowledge is in the legacy programs, in crash retrieval, and how the legacy programs have evolved, how their secrecy has evolved. When I talk about legacy programs and put out the Manhattan Project 2.0, part one and part two, I am insanely confident in those theses. Insanely confident. I will stand by that work until my dying breath. I will stand by my Northrop Grumman part two work. I will stand by my Lockheed work, my NRO project. I am insanely confident in that work. And I feel like I have a lot to offer in those topics. I have a blind spot, a huge blind spot, is actually in the taxonomy of NHI, what sort of beings they are, in terms of serious presentable research. Now, I think I have an understanding behind closed doors, but nothing that I'd feel comfortable talking about publicly, as well as any of the kind of psi stuff, psionic stuff, remote viewing stuff. That's completely out of my wheelhouse. Abductions, out of my wheelhouse. Overall experiencers and like hitchhiker effect stuff, out of my wheelhouse. I don't want to use the term nuts and bolts, but I am just a legacy programs guy and crash retrieval guy. Outside of that, I probably have a weakness in it. That's just my strong suit.
Let me ask a hypothetical question. In the course of your research, if you do uncover or become aware of a psionics program, would you investigate it?
Yeah, and I think Northrop Grumman has one.
Yeah, okay. Following the data wherever it leads.
Oh, my blind spots are everywhere. I've barely been in this subject for 3 years, so I constantly feel like I'm drowning and trying to keep up. So I just assume everything's my blind spot and just stay on edge.
Yeah,
I don't know how else to answer that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, unlike my two great friends here, like I have a job outside of UFOs and trying to, I think, navigate like the craziness of this topic and then also just try to like maintain a sense of normalcy. At times it does become challenging. And I think my blind spots, with all that said, are more so on the, like, I don't really know what I don't know, you know? And I will say, like, I've loved the time that we've had together at like the hearings and the conferences and stuff, but you know, I'm not 100% convinced even still. And I would like to be a part of like figuring out how do we get there or how to investigate these claims. But there's just a lot of things that we don't know. So I try to mitigate that by just being humble, or trying to be as humble as I can. Cause it's like, again, there's things that I just don't know about. Also, my mouth has gotten me in trouble in the past. Some people don't like me for that. It's okay. Whatever. It's a free country. First Amendment. We can have disagreements. And also I will say, like, you know, I've had disagreements with people and we've had discussions about it and I've completely flipped my perspective as well. So, you know, I think at times this community gets entrenched in like, not necessarily it's like factional thinking. Like there's kind of different groups or factions that develop and this faction doesn't want to talk to that faction because like there's some bad beef or blood. And I think it's all just kind of BS. Like, can we just rise above it and just acknowledge that this is like unprecedented times and that we got to step up to the plate in our own ways and like do what we got to do for disclosure. Like this is it. So yeah, blind spots are everywhere. I'm with Rob, but it's a lot different not being the front man of News Nation as the senior research producer for Big Dog Ross. So I don't play the same game of baseball, unfortunately.
Yeah. And before we go to the next question, oh, sorry, Rob, you go ahead.
I just want to say shout out to Mike Herrera in the chat who just said, hey,
Mike's here.
What's up, Mike?
Yeah.
Oh, hey, Mike. I got it.
Hey, thanks, dude.
Thanks for popping in.
It was a pleasure meeting you the other day. So I really quickly, I want to try and bounce through a couple of these questions that we have, because I know we have like sort of limited time. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of them that are really good.
Okay.
The first ones that I want to touch here are one that was asked both on Discord and then was also asked through a super chat here from Local HJ. So that I asked on Discord, Alien Kisser is his username there, but thoughts on Riverside Research and the growing story about McCaslin and also the CIA gold bar guy. I think we want to probably talk about that a lot more next time, because I'm going to work on a presentation about Riverside. I'm going to work with, and I don't want to say too much about Riverside Research, but please feel free to look into it. General McCaslin was apparently going to travel to Washington, D.C. to formally resign from Riverside Research. So that's the best tease that I can give you on that right now. I am going to work on a much longer form presentation than I can give on that, maybe a 15, 20 minute presentation where I break down some of the weird details that some of our friends have come up with. We also have a couple other researchers who might be willing to join us and talk about that as well. If they're interested and if that's like appropriate for the forum, we'll see, because they're very private individuals. So if not, you know, I'll be happy to present it and give them credit, but it's a cool topic. I want to move past that really quickly. Just
let me say one thing, Rob.
Yeah, go ahead.
One thing. Also, at the same time, put a pin in the gold bar CIA officer David Rush story. I have a lot to add there in terms of how SAPs work, and I would really like to tuck into that, especially with continuity of government SAPs. So put a pin in that as well, and we'll cover that a lot next time.
Because that's not an isolated incident.
Okay, yeah.
That's just, I'm just saying like that, the David Rush gold bar thing, that's not an isolated incident.
No,
things like that, I'm sure, happen all the time.
We'll put a pin in that because I want to talk about that for a good 10 or 15 minutes.
I want to answer this question, this super chat question, real quick from UAP Dingo, because I know the answer to this right away and you guys might have a quick answer too. He asks, do you know any UAP researchers that focus primarily on the NHI acquisition of Earth-based genetic material? You know, I know that Butch Witkowski did a great presentation back in the day in like 2006 or 2007 about violent human interactions, human mutilations from abductions. That's worth looking into. And then I know that Colonel John Blitch is currently in the process of writing a book on the negative interactions between humans and non-human intelligences, which covers that topic in great detail, to my understanding. So,
Rob, one sec. I'm sorry to interrupt you again, mm-hmm. but before we move on, thank you, Nano. And again, on the NPMS or NPSMS, as some people call it, it's one of the top three most cleared positions in all of the DOD, less so than the SecDef, more so than the DOD SAPCO director. And basically, the NPMS is the liaison between NSC SAPs and the DOD slash IC. So if there's unacknowledged waived NSC SAPs, the NPMS would be the person who coordinates activity across armed forces, intelligence community departments. So if there's anybody read into the NSC legacy program portfolio, it would be the director of the NPMS, which is out of the USDINS. Moving on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So our next question was, Gerb, do you get worried of retaliation for naming high-level officials inside the program? Are there any legal repercussions, or do you think lack of action is evidence of the program?
Partially, yes, I do get somewhat scared, especially when I'm in situations recently where I have my full identity has been doxxed in a private setting. I think is just kind of like a, hey, we know who you are situation. That's really uncomfortable for me. It wasn't uncomfortable when it was one of Jonathan Weygandt's Marines who responded for my uapgerb@gmail.com email with my full name. But when I'm in person and I'm introduced as, hello, this is Sam, full last name. Yes, that does sort of intimidate me. At the same time, I do not fear that an individual like Terry Phillips is going to come after me or Stephen Cantrell because of sort of the public appearance and public platform that I have. If I'm met with reprisals from these individuals, I will talk about it. And if I'm met with reprisals from, you know, Mr. Elizondo for speaking negatively about him, I will talk about that. So I do kind of fear in my private life sometimes. I do get worried, but at the same time, if there's dirty laundry that happens, I'm going to air it for my own safety.
As you should.
Question, man.
Okay, so our next question is going to be for all three. What's your thoughts on the NAA Australian declassified document that's also discussed the U.S. being publicly dismissive but internally very well known on the or well knowledgeable on the subject?
The Harry Turner memo.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly. I think we've talked about this once or twice in the past, but I'll just state very quickly that it's one of the first documents that really turned me on to the possibility of there being a there. You know, David Grush did recommend it, if I'm not mistaken, both at his press conference and on the Judicial Watch interview that he did. So I think it's a good starting place for people to get a good sort of appraisal of what an allied country sees about another allied country and how they make those decisions and determine that, you know, there's something going on there. It's a real intelligence assessment. So, yeah, it's a good doc.
At the same time, of course, we had in the 50s Canada's first and second official investigations into UFOs, Magnet and Second Story, which the impetus for these programs were based off of Robert Sarbacher's comments of Vannevar Bushing spearheading UFO crash retrieval and study teams in the 50s. So, yeah, I very much recommend looking at Wilbert B. Smith and his recommendations to Canada for setting up that story or that program as well.
Okay, great. So we have the very new last question that I've got, or actually, no, that was my last question within this set from Discord.
Should we do a rapid round for 10 minutes?
Yeah, I think we should try and do a rapid round and then wrap up.
Okay, guys, we're doing a rapid round, 10 minutes of questions. If you got one, please put it in all caps in the comments and we will get through these. I'm going to start with this wonderful super chat and then put them in the comments. I'm looking, so we'll get these. What do I know about Wendell Stevens? He has a great military story, such as losing 5 F-series planes in the late 80s to UFOs, as well as his photo collection and contacts. Chris Ramsey has quite a few of his photo collection. And of course, he was kind of the co-author on William Steinman's 1986 book on Aztec. And I think that's one of the best books on this piece. So I do have more reading of Wendell Stevens I need to do. I know he's passed, but I don't have strong enough knowledge to have a strong opinion on him as a person.
I can approach this a little bit from my own personal experience. When I was out at Contact in the Desert, I met the young lady who actually won the auction. She beat Chris Ramsey on the auction for Wendell Stevens's full photo collection.
That's right.
Chris has some of them, but this young lady has the rest of them. And it's a very, very large binder, and I was able to go through it. I will say that some of them are compelling, but I think there's only so much you can draw from photographs because not all of the photographs in that collection are originals. Most of them are reprints, and then we would have to track down the provenance of those photos through like individual markings on the back of the prints, where they were printed, when, so on and so forth. There's work to do on that, and that she is working on that actively. I don't know when we'll see that work, but some of those photos were pretty compelling. I know that also some of them were reprints of things that I had seen online prior to when the prints were made. So I know that some of them were prints that he made of things that were sent to him digitally too. So there's a firm mixture in what that collection really represents.
Okay. If Grush at the Lockheed transfer was, and thank you, by the way, was bits and pieces, whole structure, then what craft did Lakatsky enter? These are not mutually exclusive. I believe the platform Lakatsky entered was an egg-shaped vehicle. And there were several Kingman crashers. I would recommend looking into Harry Drew's 7 Days in May series. And these were, of course, saucer-shaped craft. So not mutually exclusive. I think it's highly likely Lakatsky actually had prior experience within a DIA-sponsored legacy program.
Father Chris A. Tip. Nice name.
When can we expect a video on China Lake? Probably soon, but I have on my whiteboard here, I have 4 videos I have to get to first. So this is the first time I'm actually spoiled for choice in making videos. Okay, guys, this is a good one. What do we make of Dave Grush saying most of the recovered craft are saucer, crescent, or egg-shaped? Is he inferring other commonly seen craft are ARV? No, he is not. I think these are specifically non-human platforms. And eggs of these, from what I understand, are the most common.
But the triangles
are that is. Ours. Yep, that's also what I've heard, but it's not exclusive that all the triangles are ours either. So
right. Again, time epochs and size of triangle are well worth evaluating in triangle stories. Is Plant 42 the main Northrop Grumman site with exotic tech based on your findings? That's a loaded question. Specifically Northrop Grumman site? No, Northrop Grumman has their own sites with more of Northrop Grumman's tech. But as I stated in my Hidden Wing video, Air Force Plant 42, a GOCO government-owned contractor-operated facility with Northrop, Lockheed Martin, and Boeing as the 3 contractors with access to the highly classified R&D area of such, sometimes craft, specifically reverse-engineered platforms or derivative airframes, are driven up physically from Plant 42 to Edwards Air Force Base for specific RDT&E operations. Okay, let's continue. Okay, do you guys still think there are any UFO projects or programs at Area 51?
I mean, you don't just throw away infrastructure.
Yeah.
We also have to say, what do we mean by Area 51? Is it a lot of the times when people say Area 51, they also are talking about Area 51 adjacent sites like S4, mm-hmm. Even as far down as S6 or Area 6, I'm sorry, on the Nevada test site.
So I think that there's probably quite a bit of that work being done in the Nevada National Security Area. I don't know if it's exactly on Area 51, but I do think that's what they meant when they said Area 51 is the overarching Nevada area. I personally think that there's probably still stuff there, and this is all just my thoughts. Like, it's not based on evidence or anything of that nature, but I would assume that if you go to Area 51, there's still stuff there. I mean, it's very easy just to, you know, redirect people or have like a false wall or, you know, any sort of secret thing that, like, similar to like what even Bob Lazar described with the way that the doors were concealed at the S4 site and things of that nature. Who's to say that that can't also be the case? And some people show up for an inspection and they're just simply not going to find it. So.
Yeah, I mean, one of the people I think of is Randy Anderson, and Randy Anderson was running Op 4, opposing force drills on the Nevada test site near Area 51 on DOE-controlled lands. He has been very explicit that some of these either permanent stations or semi-permanent stations out there near Area 51 mm-hmm. do in fact house triangles. There was an Army Public Affairs officer I talked to that in 2013, as recently when. For specific reasons, he was at Area 51. He observed a triangle on the cleared flight line. So I kind of agree with Rob. What do you think, Kerm?
Yeah, I think Area 51 is a big place. I mean, if the cabal was smart about it, they probably wouldn't have it there anymore, but I wouldn't be surprised if there was work going on there. I mean, it's not the only place, right? Like, I think a lot of people in the public are like, oh, well, you know, the U.S. government's got a secret alien program. It's got to be at Area 51, right? No, 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 no. This is all across the country. It's international. We've at least touched on or talked about more than 24 locations, at least on live streams. Gerb's covered even more than that. So it's a big state. It's a big architecture. And, you know, I think everyone focusing on Area 51, it's kind of disingenuous because, like, that's the secret facility that the government wants you to know about. There are even more secret ones that they don't tell you about and don't make it into the media. And hey, if I was running the show, that's where I'd be testing the craft. But again, they don't put me in charge of shit. So,
yeah, and I'll still maintain that in the early 90s, a lot of the Area 51 infrastructure was moved towards the Utah range, towards the Edwards range. So in places like that. Okay, we talked about this a little bit. Is the Avi Loeb group focusing only on new evidence to completely avoid outing any legacy programs? I don't know if it's specifically to avoid outing legacy programs. I just think there might be some taboo in touching old data sets, or possibly it's too murky and thus they want to avoid it. And I hope that's not the case.
Oh, there was a question up above that I wanted to address. Somebody asked, okay. Do you know how to get off of the Jack Sarfati email list? No.
Are you on it, Rob?
No, I managed to delete that email account.
That's the only way then. You have to delete your email account entirely. There's no other option. You can't escape Jack Sarfati. Once he has you, you're in his grasp. It's like a tractor beam from Star Wars.
Exactly.
So Diadonix, I think he said this and I missed it. What would be your ideas on the most fruitful path for disclosure in the OPINT, Open Intelligence, and the UAP UFO disclosure research community? I think that in terms of where the average person is going with the quality of their research, the quality of their sort of discussion on this topic, it's very bright. I mean, look, Rob Jones said he was a newcomer to this subject, and within 2 years, he's working as a research producer at News Nation. Kerm says he's kind of a newcomer to this topic, and he's publishing great projects on the topic and is really engaged with it. So I would just look at what these two guys are doing, continuing to do due diligence, talk to folks. And I think these two are the model for how folks out in the open can really kind of progress and add to the disclosure process. What do you guys think?
And I mean, the best thing that you can possibly do in getting involved with this is to constantly be your own greatest critic and to constantly question your own biases and constantly question the validity of the sources of your information. That's the best advice I could give anyone.
Yeah. And keep notes as well. This is something that I think shot me in the foot initially, because I'm just someone that just like has a bunch of tabs open and I get lost into the sauce. And then a couple months down the road, it's like, hey, remember this? And then I completely lose context for it. So especially right now, and I think the past couple of years has kind of shown this dynamic where one thing will be said initially, and then either more information will come out or something else comes out that may counter that initial claim. So when in doubt, just write it down, bookmark the posts, like just try to keep track of this stuff. It's a lot. It's especially just an information like fire hose at times, especially on certain days or weeks. But I will say some of the like AI tools are actually pretty helpful and effective. And I have leveraged them at times just to like get sentiment analysis or just like summarize what happened on Twitter that day. So those things are helpful at times, but again, just like making sure that you're able to like understand where you got to that point. Cause especially like with the rabbit hole and getting down into the weeds, like you just want to be crystal clear on kind of how this started and how you got to that point. So that's kind of more on research in general, but.
Okay, rapid fire. Yeah. We'll get through a few more and we'll close it up because I know you got to go, okay. Rob. Good one. Do you think the programs have figured out enough to produce man-made craft and at scale? Rob, go.
Yes, but in extremely, extremely limited quantities and sizes.
Yeah. The materials are the constraints, and that's not just for craft, but also actual derivative technologies that may be deployable for warfare capabilities. A lot of the times, the programs are constrained by the amount of metamaterials the amount of craft materials one would have. So therefore, when I've seen the argument, hey, if UFOs are recovered, why is there such a mad dash to kind of hoard as much of a collection as you need? You are indeed a lot of the time constrained by the amount of materials you have. And there is a worry there of a Trojan horse. Maybe too many U.S. tech derivative technologies are too over-reliant on the materials, and thus we're at an extreme competitive disadvantage when we require more materials and may be willing to do things we otherwise would.
And I'll just add on, but just like conceptually, like if you just follow the logic, like a big program would leave a bigger footprint. So if they had like a secret space program, for example, and I briefly covered this on one of my slides, but like a large operation like that, I think would leave a much bigger paper trail than what we are seeing currently. So I'll let you kind of decipher what that means. I do not think it's as robust, or they have not built as many weapons, I think, as some people, or craft, as some people would claim that they have.
Rob was asked this question. He says he doesn't know. So this is just for the record, if people start hounding Rob about this.
I don't know the location. I made a joke earlier today on Twitter that I know a specific location that someone tried to say where it was. I know it's not there because I asked Ross, because that's where I thought it was too. And he said no. But I also said to Ross, hey, look, I also don't really want to know. So,
okay. Thank you so much. We just got to address this, guys. I don't really understand the idea behind disclosure being dangerous. Could you explain some of the main hypotheses that support this argument? Here's one example. Maybe we'll all give an example and then we can start to close up. Let's say we have a derivative capability from a craft. This wouldn't even need to be a weapon system. Maybe it's an electro-optic cloaking system. Maybe it's a radar system. And we've convinced our peer adversaries, or our peer adversaries don't know this capability exists. And the certain elements of our intelligence community and armed forces community are using this for intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, ISR purposes. If we have a massive catastrophic leak and it's shown that the U.S. has this capability, then our peer adversaries know that we have this capability. We'll attempt to also harness this capability. We'll try and use spycraft to infiltrate our intelligence systems to find this capability. And it's just a runaway cause and effect for other countries to try and leverage and get a hold of this once asymmetric warfare capability.
Yeah. And I will say, like, I think the geopolitical national security kind of angle, that's relevant and important. But I think disclosure is dangerous, is like, it's multifaceted, because there is the national security angle, but also kind of going back to my comments about like, are the UFOs angels and demons? Like, that is also another tactic or kind of plot line that's introduced to kind of get at the concept that this stuff is dangerous. And I did see actually a chat or a super chatter that we did not answer the question to, of like, basically, is the belief, or you know, is the demanding of UFO disclosure hypocritical to the belief of God? Those are two completely separate things. Like, I believe in God wholeheartedly. Demanding transparency and disclosure on this is separate from that. I do not, these things are completely mutually exclusive, and like enforcing or at least advocating for the truth, like that's a virtuous and good thing. Like, I don't understand why that would be against it. But you do see that come up a lot, of like, oh, well, you know, the exorcist that recently got fired because he made comments about, you know, UFOs, or at least the stuff that they were seeing in the church with exorcisms having some affiliation with UFOs, or at least like gray alien reports. And while that exists, like, do not jump to conclusions and say that like, oh my gosh, it's all demonic, because that's not true. And it's also disingenuous to the truth itself. The national security angle, I agree with Gerb. It's a valid point, and I think that's a valid thing to consider, especially when making decisions here. But when looking at other kind of ways that disclosure is dangerous gets like purported, you really have to like put your skeptical hat on for a minute and like think critically. My two cents.
Yeah. Before we end, one thing I wanted to double back on is something you mentioned about the difference between whether they're going to have old data sets or new data sets with this new UAP Science Advisory Council. And one of the things that actually did come up, and I was busy reading questions, so I didn't get the chance to mention this, is that my understanding is that when this got brought up with Avi, he said that he was only interested in new data sets personally. But that doesn't mean that the other members of the council aren't going to be requesting additional data sets beyond that for them to continue to study. So it doesn't close the door on older data sets at all.
Good. I think that was important to say.
Yep, guys, absolutely.
I am sorry. We are going to have to wrap up because Rob has a hard cutoff. Let me just say before we move on, just so you guys have something to look forward to, we've already planned the next live. We have Kerm's excellent PowerPoint. Mm-hmm. We have some work from Rob, and we're going to talk about fake continuity of government saps that have been used to embezzle money out. So do you guys have any closing remarks before we head out for the day?
Just we appreciate the support. Please tune in to UAP GURB. Please watch his most recent video and give it some views.
Kerm?
Thanks, everyone. Let's go Disclosure. Let's go TR3B. Isn't it great, guys? This is so fun. This is awesome. Well,
and you know what? One more thing I want to say before we let go is that it's never a bad thing to hold people in power accountable, okay? It is never a bad thing to hold people in power accountable. Just because you're attempting to hold somebody in power accountable doesn't mean that you're calling them a bad person or anything like that. It means that you are being a good citizen and, in my case, a good journalist. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to leave it at that.
Okay, as Jeremy Corbell would say, go, go, UFO, and we will catch you guys on the next stream.
Go, go, UFO!
Bye, everybody.
See y'all.